Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for introducing yourself very briefly. It's thrilling to be here and sharing a little bit of this. It draws on specifically some work that I've been doing on linking the capabilities approach with ICT4D, and doing that specifically in the context of a case study which was looking at micro-entrepreneurs in rural Chile and how they saw the ICT policies of the Chilean state. So it hopefully touches on both the kind of the specifics of the Chilean case as well as on some theoretical level work. And please, I'm basically going to do sort of a half hour or so of the material, and then please ask me questions if you want to go deeper into particular elements here. All of this is essentially coming out as a book with MIT Press, and I'm just kind of finishing the manuscript now, so hope is that it's coming out next year. To start out with, I think something that is potentially echoes with experiences here in the Tasha group is that the ICT4D field can be characterized as also a field of a lot of hype. And particularly when it comes to a discourse which kind of shows that sort of ICTs are supposed to be kind of facilitating globalization, often with a focus on economic globalization. And there's a sort of a discourse of, you know, judging countries as backwards if a particular technology hasn't been adopted yet, and there's indicators of e-readiness and so on that basically line up different countries in sort of a historical queue. This kind of discourse assumes also that there's some sort of positive effect associated with technology, or indeed that technology is neutral. There is less of a discussion about unintended consequences and indeed negative consequences of such technology. And the logic of assuming that there's generally a positive effect of ICTs is that digital divides become this big moral imperative. So if there's positive effects associated with technology, then the inequalities of the spread of ICTs between countries and within societies, as Norris puts it, becomes this kind of key issue. There's others who've pointed out that actually technology is imbued with normative decisions, with ideologies. Castells talks about the origins of technologies in particular societies and makes the point about the internet emerging from a particular, you know, what he calls sort of liberal campus culture of sort of particularly Anglo-America, and how this is also some of the kind of founding ideologies of particular technologies. Judith Weissman, coming from sort of a techno-feminist approach, kind of talks about how it's also the framing institutions that have particular expectations and specific norms written into them. So all of a sudden we're moving into a space which is talking about technology in a much more sort of normative way. And I guess that's where I would broadly place my work, is kind of trying to deconstruct technology in that direction. This isn't coming out of the blue. For anyone who's kind of worked on development studies will be aware that sort of development studies itself is a deeply normative field, and these paradigms have been sort of shifting. New paradigms have been introduced, and I've kind of flippantly put 1949 there. Anyone an idea why I put 1949? Truman's inaugural kind of speech about development would be kind of the date there. And of course, immediately, as a geographer, I have my sort of post-colonial colleagues kind of telling me that actually these kinds of discussions about development and backwardsness go back much, much longer, and point out to the links of colonialism as well at this point. But if we just kind of look at some of the more familiar paradigms since then, we can see, you know, some of the kind of big orthodox paradigms of, you know, economic growth being very prominent, modernization, technological progress, discussions about catching up, and some would add leapfrogging into this kind of debate, discussions around basic needs kind of coming in there, debates about social inequality or equality, opportunity there. And then another big sort of new orthodoxy, possibly talking about sustainable development. And by that I don't mean just sort of financial sustainability, which is often, you know, the way that we in ICT4D sustainability is used. I'm kind of actually talking about sustainable development as used in mainstream development studies in terms of balancing ecological, social, and economic aspects. That's a big paradigm which I think is definitely increasingly integrated into discussions of development. And then there's another sort of heterodox set of paradigms, and I would count well-being in there, happiness in various measurement forms, freedom, and when I say freedom, I'm kind of referring to mainly Amartya Sen's capabilities approach here. And there's other paradigms, and certainly this isn't a complete list. So just as a refresher, Amartya Sen's point here is that he would suggest that development can be seen as a process of expanding the real freedoms that people enjoy. And specifically, he suggests focusing on the substantive freedom of people to lead the lives that they have reason to value and to enhance the real choices they have. And what I find particularly attractive about this framing of development is that it's very much, it's people-centered and specific, and it goes towards the, it shifts the normative decisions very much to the local and the individual, getting away from sort of one-size-fits-all universalist account of development. Capabilities in this context are essentially alternative functionings, and this is a whole lingo that Sen develops. Some of you will be familiar with this. I don't have time to go into great detail here, but it's worth using some of this terminology to also understand the depth of theory that gets us in, with the big difficulty coming out of this is that this theoretical richness that the approach suggests also means it's hugely difficult to operationalize. And you can have, the Human Development and Capabilities Association conferences, you have a whole strand of sessions that just basically people putting their heads together worrying about operationalizing the approach.
What is alternative functions? Can you say just a bit about what that refers to?
Sure. Basically, the way that Sen conceptualized functionings are the kind of the various things that the person may value doing or being. And capabilities are essentially the options that are available to do that. So functionings are usually seen as the achieved functionings, so what people are actually able to do. So for example, if you are kind of talking about someone who's currently able to eat food but chooses to not eat food because they choose to be on hunger strike, then their functioning is that they're not eating food. Yeah, they're not actually doing it, but they have the capability to have food. They just choose not to. So the idea here is to allow people to do the things that they value, or indeed be in the states that they value. So it's the options that people have, rather than actually measuring outcomes. And this is kind of key in order to sort of allow for people's choices to be realized. So choice plays an important role here as well. My sort of small contribution to this operationalization debate has been just one framework. There's several frameworks, but this is one framework of trying to translate this kind of theoretical depth of the capabilities approach for actual usage in ICT4D. And what I'm trying to capture here is essentially a dialogical relationship between structure and agency. So when I'm talking about agency, for example, I'm talking about both the material and immaterial resources that the individual has. So I list 10 resources here, educational resources, psychological resources, information, financial resources, cultural resources, social or natural material, geographical resources, and health as elements of this agency component. But I also recognize, and this is important because particularly in the critiques of the capability approach, the overemphasis on agency is often a point of criticism. I do recognize a lot of structural limitations to the agency of the individual. So I've got a strong kind of point here on structure, where I recognize that there are the opportunity structure that consists of things like institutions, organizations, and discourses being, from my point of view, a real, really important part of structure, which doesn't appear in many other frameworks, policies, formal and informal laws, and technology and innovations in there as well. So it's the combination of this sort of the resource portfolio and the personal characteristics that an individual has and how they can then make use of an existing structure. And at the same time recognize that those structures are actually set up by individuals. So it's with kind of Giddens structuration theory, it's basically a connectedness between agency and structure that goes both ways. Out of this comes sort of different levels of empowerment, where I also emphasize the importance of recognizing not just the existence of choice, but also the sense of choice. So, and how far people actually realize that these opportunities are available. So I've basically mentioned here the elements in the framework, the different parts of the framework. I haven't touched on outcomes yet. And this is, for me, this is important because outcomes for me is not necessarily something that is primarily set from outside. Outcomes is, in the logic of Zen, something that individuals choose for themselves. It's them who define what kind of lives they have reason to value. So the primary outcome with Zen is choice, and then the secondary outcomes here are not for me to define. These are things that the individual defines, and I'm just suggesting some examples under secondary outcomes here. But this list is individually set, and it's not a list that I can make for what people value more generally. I have to stop there, but it's basically not a Nussbaum but a Zen capabilities approach here, but it's in that space. I'd suggest different ways of applying the choice framework. So one is just looking at value systems that are embedded in technologies, actually asking whether that values that these technologies actually allow for more choice of the individual. I use it to look at cases, qualitative work, in a more structured way, also cross comparisons of cases, and I'm using it in the context of actually planning for choice in terms of action research. We'll see how far I get with kind of explaining some of the things I mean here. The particular context in which I've worked with this, and I should stress that the framework basically came out of a combination in grounded theory work, a combination of theoretical thinking and on-the-ground field research. So this is basically something that has kind of evolved, and I see this as an evolving tool. It's a living tool. It's hopefully useful to others who may or may not choose to adapt, change, or whatever, work with it. I don't have to tell you much about Chile, I think, in this particular audience. Basically, we're looking at a particular case in Latin America, one of the big success stories of the World Bank, with continued economic growth, low levels of corruption. I think this is significant. High degrees of literacy, and on various kind of indicators, high levels of so-called eco readiness. So good situation for ICT-assisted development. At the same time, high degree of social inequality and regional inequality. So we're also looking at a big risk of so-called digital divides, and indeed quite a diversity of the lives that people potentially might be valuing. This is just kind of reminding you that Chile is kind of continuously was then and still is one of the leaders in sort of ICT policy and practice in Latin America. So this is the context in which policies are made. This is Santiago, again familiar to many of you, and connoisseurs of metros worldwide will probably agree that sort of the Santiago Metro is an example of basically potential, very much a kind of high-tech environment, very clean, very slick, and very Wi-Fi friendly. The policies or the political framework that I'll be talking about is was basically the context of the Concertación government of the centre-left and socialists. So a combination, this was under Lagos and Bachelet, where essentially there was a consensus to continue with the neoliberal economic macroeconomic framework, while at the same time trying to introduce social policies to fight poverty. So a sort of a combination of both a sort of neoliberal economic policy and a poverty reduction policy. In this context, then, you have this visionary, one can say, national ICT agenda, the Agenda Digital. And this was a wider regulatory framework which included a whole set of action lines. In my research, I didn't look at all the different individual action lines. The ones I focused on were particularly the infocentros, and amongst sort of the different telecenter models, I was looking particularly at the Red Comunitaria ones. I was looking at the Campaña de Alfabetización Digital, and I was looking at the e-procurement system Chilecompra. So, for some of you, this is kind of very familiar territory. For some of you, maybe less so. But this is kind of an example of an info center in the south of Chile, where essentially the policy was to have to increase social inclusion and access to information, access to particularly the online space or to cyberspace, having sort of a right to access, in a sense, expressed through a public access point. And these were essentially public access points that were free to access, small fees for printing and other things and so on. And in this particular model of telecenters, this was right next to the libraries, next door to them. And this was also the base where the IT courses would be run. In a parallel setup, there was the move in the context of increased e-government from offline procurement to online procurement. So here, the goals were more sort of the discussion around increasing transparency, increasing efficiency in public procurement. And there was a drive to switch in 2005 from an offline procurement system to an online procurement system for all purchases of goods and services over around $50. And this meant that basically all the, this was at municipal level, hospitals, schools, local municipios and so on had to kind of switch their procurement to this. There are certain things that weren't allowed, for example, specifying the names of the company or their origins. It was essentially a competition on price levels that was kind of being taking place here via reverse auction online. And this very much fit in with a kind of a sort of general plan to increase the competitiveness of companies, Chilean companies, to also compete with foreign companies in a macroeconomic context where the overriding plan was basically to have an export-led growth model and a very open economy. This is the local reality. So we have a synchronized situation where we have different technologies, including transport technologies, sitting alongside each other. We have a situation in rural Chile where there's private investment in infrastructure, for example, also in cyber cafes, but there is also a lack in public investment in infrastructure, as you can see sort of the potholes in the street there. So there was real issues in actually municipios not being able to kind of fund paving roads and so on, and then setting up info centers had to compete with other priorities locally, while sort of the spread of cyber cafes was kind of going ahead in these localities. I'm going to specifically talk about one particular town, which I'm just going to call Algún here. It was a town of 13,000 inhabitants in one of the poorest areas of Chile, in the ninth region. High degree of unemployment, official figures around 13% here. High degree of underemployment, which wasn't properly reported. A town that had lost over the past decade about 10% of its inhabitants to out-migration, mainly due to lack of job opportunities. But at the same time, a sort of a thriving tradition of shared communications access, at least. So you had public telephones, you had call centers, cyber cafes. I did 6 months of field work split over a year, so kind of checking through the course of three sets of 2 months, basically seeing how the situation developed over the course of a year, and you could see how cyber cafes, for example, when I started the work, there were 5 cyber cafes in this town. At the end, there were 7. There was sort of activities in this area. The computer school was, essentially 3 computers in a household, and the guy basically sitting down with individual sort of students to explain them stuff. And there was the info center, the blue dot here, which was located next to the public library, or in the same building as the library there. Local entrepreneurs spoke about the internet in the context of to be digitally alphabetized, copying what competitors do, talking about knowledge advantage. Some who had heard about Chile Compra talking about gaining orders that way, but also a huge sense of pressure about not being left behind. It's globalization. Whoever does not take part in the change dies. It's sort of not necessarily just a positive choice, but also a fear of not what would happen if they weren't partaking in this technological change. But it was okay because what was available was this. There was info centers with free access. There were free courses available, and Chile Compra was being offered as a great kind of business opportunity.
Just to be digitally alphabetized.
As in digital literacy. So this was basically being suggested as sort of a new universal citizen skill that needed to be taken on board. Not necessarily very specifically defined. I'm going to take an individual case, partly because this also allows me to show also how one might use the choice framework in the analysis here. So this is Marta Castillo, name changed here, but she's a single mom, head of a household, looking after kind of 3 children of different ages, and an aging grandmother. She's on a low income with basic education. And her important element in her biography was that she spent 9 years as a nana in Santiago, as a cook or maid for a rich family there. And this means that she's got very good cooking skills. And she actually uses these skills to produce jam, cakes, pastries, and doughs locally to sell to both private and public clients. So public clients would be essentially like a catering service for schools, or indeed her aspiration was to also serve local hospitals. she'd done, in many ways, she'd done everything right. She'd taken the free IT course for out-of-school adults at the Infra Center. She'd used the internet in the Infra Center to research for recipes, innovate on her product, and diversify her production, particularly in terms of finding recipes for diabetics. And she was hoping to organize a women's group in order to service larger orders that might be coming from public bodies, such as particularly the hospitals and schools. So if I look at her particular case, this doesn't come up fantastically, but I hope you can read it. Basically, if we look at her agency first, Marta, her material and financial resources were extremely limited. She had reasonable health, low education, but sort of had this particular skill of the cooking skills. And her information level was reasonably good, partly because she was relying on her social resources to stay in the loop. And her social resources included the director of the local Info Center. So she was involved in that, lived relatively central in town. So here's the geographical resources. She was located relatively close to the Info Center. And particularly her psychological resources played a role. I think I'll just take a moment to just kind of read from the interview with her to give you a sense of the psychological resources here. So she says, "People listen to me, and it's funny because my husband used to say to me, 'You are worth nothing, you are nothing.' And now I see how they congratulate me and say, 'Senora Marta, your husband has no idea what he's lost.'" So this is the husband who's kind of left her. "So this is what lifts one's ego up, because they have seen how I've worked and got myself out of the dirt, as one says, doing 1,000 things. There are many female heads of households, and on their own, they have to face being mama and papa, send their kids to school, feed them, dress them, and everything. And one promises oneself, 'This month, I will manage to put this much aside.' And one keeps one's promise, with tears running down, but one keeps one's promise. I've kept going for 10 years now, getting up at 6 and going to bed at 12, with the alarm clock in my hand, because otherwise I would sleep through it. And I've not rested a single day." So this is Marta talking about her life and her routine here. And this is where I would kind of be arguing that what she has and what sometimes isn't reflected in a lot of the kind of frameworks that we use is also this immaterial resources, psychological resources. So if you look at development literature, social resources aren't the only resources or capitals of the poor, but also I would argue psychological resources play a strong role here, and it certainly plays a role in trying to understand how different people use technology. Looking at the structure, there's certainly new institutions such as the telecenters that have come into town that are changing the situation. There are new discourses in Chile talking about digital alphabetization, the need to kind of acquire these new skills. There are new policies and programs, including on the one hand InfoCenter's literacy campaign and so on, but also Chile Compra. And I can go into the norms on the usage of space, but basically that this is also an important element in terms of how these norms, particularly gendered norms, on the use of time and the use of space in this rural community affect how women can use the cybercafes and can use the telecenters here. And the technologies and innovations have changed, as have availability, affordabilities, of ICTs. So that has changed in the structure. What then has happened is that Marta knows that this choice is available to her to go online. This choice exists, she has a sense of it, and she uses it, and in some ways she achieves her goal, as in she does get this information on her recipes for diabetics, for example. We'll get to the element of her choice there, where she's not successful. So on the development outcomes, she does achieve choice. She achieves easier communication, increased knowledge, and increased income in connection with these kind of diversification of her production. So it's one, you know, the framework here helps me to explain the case in a systematic way.
Are you saying that she was able to set up her own business because of the task I had to run it through?
No, she had her business beforehand. Okay. She's just expanding, diversifying her production.
So she was able to buy recipes, mm-hmm. for diabetics, things like that.
Exactly, yeah.
So she wasn't really handling the business side, it's more the creative side.
Well, she's the only person who works in this enterprise. So she's all sides together.
Mm-hmm. So she wasn't finding new customers? She already had the customers?
She had the private clients and had the links with the hospital and the school. But what she was trying to do was, yes, she was trying to explore more customers. And she was also trying to intensify her relationships with the schools and the hospital. One of the things she was keen at to have was to have a sort of a continuous contract to kind of bring in catering services or indeed supply the hospital with, say, jam, with, her cookies and so on. Same for school.
So was she running her business out of her home?
Yes, in that she had a home with next to it a kind of a, not industrial scale, but, you know, bigger scale kitchen.
So we have to live for you, and I don't know more about this, but she didn't have a computer.
She didn't have a computer at home, no.
So what was she doing to maintain the books and accounts of everything she needed?
Hand books, basically. Accounting wasn't.
So she was just going to the center for her book recipes?
Information, yes. Information and communication in that way, but not for bookkeeping. So one of the things, what stuck out, however, was that basically the Chili Comperer innovation for Marta Castillo didn't work out in that she had never used it at the time, and in the meantime, the local hospital started sourcing strictly according to the criteria, which was very much price-focused, sourcing their jam, i.e. prime Marta product, from an importadora, a kind of a large distributor in Santiago that kind of put together different items of food in one package, offered this at sort of very low prices, and basically sent it 8 hours south on a truck to the local municipio. So in a sense, that was, you know, it was kind of, Chile Comfort achieved its goal of efficiency in the narrow sense that it was cheaper to source that way. This wasn't like the only case. Generally, the smaller enterprises had both access issues with Chile Compra and struggled to compete on price. And in this particular rural community, there weren't any large businesses. And we were kind of looking at you know, depending on your definition, at best, you know, small, medium-sized enterprises here. And the same applied also across sectors. So production, commerce, and services were struggling with, you know, their margins coming down as a result of the procurement system. I'll have to go past that. So to kind of summarize some of the local situation here, it was that the micro-entrepreneurs, many of them used the telecenter and attended these free IT courses. There were some interesting gendered norms surrounding the use of time and space that played a role here in terms of the usage of the telecenter. The micro-entrepreneurs had problems to access Chile Compra and then to compete within it. And the net effect of Chile Compra was that there were less orders from the local authority being placed locally. Ironically, however, if you look at these sort of these policies separately, then you have to basically say that both were success stories. So Chile Compra achieved what it set out to do, which was transparency and efficiency in a narrow sense. In other words, getting, you know, the same set of products for at a cheaper price from the taxpayer. In a sort of more holistic understanding of what you could do with procurement, it may not have been a success in the same way. But, you know, in the narrow sense, it was efficient. And then the infocentres also, you know, reached their goal of social inclusion and equal opportunity here. So both initiatives were successful. They were running under the same umbrella of the ICT policy, the national ICT policy here, but it was at the local level where some of the contradictions in the overall governmental policy, which combined or tried to combine a neoliberal economic framework with these policies against poverty, where these contradictions became visible. And I find this particularly interesting because it's essentially talks, you know, it kind of shows how these ideologies can be embedded in the technology. And it's when then the two ideologies embedded in those technologies kind of meet each other at the local level that these contradictions become evident. So going all the way back to kind of my paradigm here of talking about, you know, looking at this from Sen's perspective, then if we take development to mean freedom of the people to lead the lives that they have reason to value and enhance the real choices that they have, then we have to ask, you know, whether the particular technological change, system change here, furthers or hinders this goal. And we might come to different conclusions for the different subsets of the agenda digital, for different sort of answers for telecenters, the digital literacy campaign, or Chilicompra. And on a theoretical level, for me, the choice framework stands as a living tool which can be used for these different purposes. For a deconstruction exercise about what values are embedded in this technology, for a systematic mapping of these cases, hopefully theorizing about on the basis of qualitative data, and then finally planning for choice and engaging with people about what kind of lives people value, and then having a participatory design process on technology. That's another talk, which I can't do right now, but there's definitely the story goes on in terms of what do you then do with that if you actually want to do action research and apply that. So I hope that gives us some kind of material to go into. I'm sure you've got challenges. I've also got sort of challenges here prepared, but I think given the time, I think I should hand over to you. Thank you.
I got a question.
Yeah.
On your next slide, or the last one, you're working on a book that is about to come.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned 2007 paper of yours, you presented something at ICTV in Doha. What is the best source to cite this emergent framework as you have it considered it now?
At the moment, basically there is there's different emphases. It's a living tool, so it's evolving. The more comprehensive write-up of the Doha paper is actually in Information Technologies and International Development. There's a longer paper in there writing that up. If you're interested in the emergence of the framework, that's in Ethics and that's the Journal of Ethics and Information Technology. And I think it's really important to understand that, you know, I'm not in any way claiming that this is sort of completely come out of nowhere. This is based on sort of other frameworks, such as the DFID framework and also Alsop and Heinsohn's work on empowerment at the World Bank. So if you're interested in the emergence, where this has come from, this might be also an interesting sort of paper. And then hopefully from next year on, I think in the book I get a chance to explain in greater depth the individual elements of the framework. Go for it.
I love it. It's very very interesting. I love the approach, and we discussed about the framework before. So it's really interesting that you're pointing towards the contradictions of two national policies that are meant to for the same objective, but they come from different mentality, ideology, and also conceptions of technology, right? The technocentric neoliberal approach versus the social. And I think it's still present in Chile probably today and in other parts. My question would be, how do you think in that, in thinking about the choice framework, how do you think those contradictions affect the agency of people?
In terms affect of the choice,
the agency and the choice and the sense of choice.
Well, one of the things I find interesting about the these different sort of different aspects and ideological aspects in sort of the Chilean politics is that you know, this much has been written about the supposed lack of civil society in Chile or thinness of civil society. Well, I think it's growing, number one, but it's also there is still a paucity of heterodox discourse. So there's a lot of, from my perspective, one of the things that struck me, I mean, I come, you know, in from a UK perspective, in the UK there's plenty of sort of basically sort of dominant economic discourse, which essentially means that, you know, a supposed almost like an sort of inability to think outside and like sort of a concept of constant economic growth. You know, we know that basically the current growth model isn't sustainable, and yet, you know, along comes a financial crisis, and the suggestion is that we consume ourselves out of this kind of crisis. No? Great. So essentially this inability to sort of adapt you know, our thinking, or at least considering alternatives. So what I find very interesting is how these discourses that are up there in the structure, how they affect the sense of agency and the sense of choice of people. So what is actually open in terms of the choice? So for example, for local, this is kind of a slide I skipped, but if you look at the public servant here, what they were saying, there was a training course and they talked about globalization, and that we as a local community have to integrate us into that, integrate a small town into Chilecompra. And we tried to explain it was very difficult, small and impoverished municipio with very few resources to integrate ourselves into that, that the system was designed for large cities, but now there's nothing left but to adapt to the system. There's nothing else one can do apart from that one is a public servant, so we're sworn to obedience. They implement the system, there's a law that protects them, we need to adapt. So the discourse here that's behind this is the story of Chile as a winner in globalization, and the story of Chile being a winner because of technological progress and an open market, neoliberal, export-led model. And it trickles down. This kind of discourse trickles all the way down. And it means this public servant doesn't think in terms of, you know, what can I do to help my local economy that, you know, sort of essentially pays my wages. And if we're constantly losing people, our town is shrinking, our municipio might be shrinking, my job might be going. But that's not on the horizon because he's caught up in a discursive space which affects his agency, if that makes any sense.
Thank you.
This was done entirely under Lagos?
Sorry? This is Lagos and then Bachelet, but very, very beginnings of Bachelet.
The impression I get is that the new administration is much less interested in outreach and social inclusion. That branch of what you're talking about may be undercut, and so the kind of case you presented may not nearly receive the support that the other model does. And so this may be a critical test of these against one another under the new regimes.
I mean, just, you know, sort of what might be a plausible trajectory in the current sort of situation. We, you know, we know that if you want, if you look at those two things that they were trying to keep in balance, I would say the neoliberal economic policy is going to take over in many ways. And you know, in a way, in many ways, Chile was sort of a test case for a lot of neoliberal policy historically, and I wouldn't be surprised if we're kind of seeing more of a discourse of trickle down again, of basically a story of, you know, basically if we only focus on economic growth, then at some point the poor will also benefit. I think an important counter trend to that, if I've got it, I don't know, is the fact I've got it just somewhere here. Is the fact that now, this was Felipe Goya of Chile Compra talking about, you know, the role of Chile Compra in my interview. So he was kind of saying, Chile Compra is like an instrument which reflects the economy of Chile today, which is more or less neoliberal. Oh, sorry, this is me summarizing. So I'm talking about how isn't Chile Compra like the current economic model? And he agrees, and he says, well, yeah, because the government deals with these topics, the social and environmental issues, via other channels, those are more appropriate. Chile Compra is aligned to the economic model, which is neoliberal. And he's totally fine with that. This is 2005. And he's explicitly saying, we focus on the economic, not the social and environmental. That's not our business. Now, this is late 2010, and the same Felipe Goya, who's now a director of Chile Compra, announces that Chile Compra will be one of the first public e-procurement systems in Latin America to incorporate not just financial cost, but also energy efficiency as a criteria, which to me is an indication that what we're seeing here is that a shift in discourse towards more environmental discourse is being reflected in changes to the technology. And it's exciting in a way because this is under Piñera. This is within the neoliberal economic space, the sort of the bigger dominant discourse. There's also an ecological discourse still playing out. So, I think at least on the economic, on the environmental side, the verdict is out in terms of how that will be integrated. And it's interesting that a big motivator seems to be here to be the first, to be the innovator, to be the leader in Latin America, which is something that I think chimes with Chilean identity and the way that Chileans see themselves as being kind of forerunners. So I think it's that direction that this kind of is leading. Mm-hmm.
Question about the primary and secondary choices, just kind of understanding the model. So the primary choice, or the primary is the choice. Mm-hmm. The primary
goal.
Sorry, what was it?
Development outcome.
Outcomes, I'm sorry, outcomes. Mm-hmm. So the primary outcomes and secondary outcomes. So is it conceivable then that one could have increased choice but not achieved some of the other outcomes? And then how does that play out?
Can you give an example?
Well, an example, because you know, let's say you have the choice of participating in Chile Compra, and maybe they do. They might not win the bid. But they still might feel that they've had the choice or have felt that they participated in a way that expanded their choices.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to, or is the primary outcome always a stepping stone to, or is the primary a stepping stone to a secondary, or is the primary literally, or is the primary in and of itself the end outcome?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I've articulated that well, but I'm just trying to understand the interplay between the primary and the secondary outcomes. We interviewed some folks a couple of weeks ago, and their experience with Chile Compra was actually a lot better.
I'm sure.
And people kept coming back to bid because they had been successful at earlier bids. So they thought it was a way for them to come.
Mm-hmm.
To the sense they got, not very representative, but
yeah.
The sense that they thought this was a way to get in. On those government procurement projects. So, but anyway, I think my main question is really about how those the primary and secondary relate to one another.
I think there's two things. I think on the specific case of Chile Compra, I think one shouldn't underestimate this element, the issue of transparency here. And basically in a situation where some producers particularly felt that they were excluded from procurement because they didn't have the right network, the right contacts, whatever, this was a great step forward. And I wouldn't ever suggest to get rid of to the comptroller in the sort of sense of, you know, losing all that transparency that has been gained. But I would suggest that you can separate the issue of accountability and transparency and the issue of the criterion being just based on economic cost. So my suggestion is to have a participatory and sort of a public discussion, deliberation around what should be appropriate criteria for public procurement. And it may well be that social and environmental criteria are applied to public procurement choices.
I was wondering that energy efficiency was also saying that not having a truck coming out from Santiago, but actually
exactly
sourcing more locally.
Yep. And I think that's, I mean, to me, this is extremely exciting news, that there's movement on this front, because I think it will change the landscape. I think it's, to some degree, it's sort of choosing, again, something that is can be potentially a metric. It's a very complicated metric, but it's something that's a metric, you know, energy efficiency, life. My colleagues in physical geography can give you more and so on, but basically is this a life cycle measure, you know, how do you account for the final loop? There's a whole sort of issue there, but I think it's exciting to see that there's an attempt to introduce other factors and criteria in there as well. I think on the theoretical point here is essentially that I guess what I don't get is whether there can be ever, you know, whether I can't think of, you know, I think choice is always linked to choice of what. So I can't think of an example where you don't have a what. So therefore, I guess for me, I don't ever get a situation where all you achieve is choice, because choice is always choice of what.
Well, the other things are, in terms of the outcomes, are increased income. Those are many factors to whether you're able to achieve the increased income that might be out of your control at any given time.
Yeah.
So, are we making advances if you're expanding choices or expanding those things? But it's looking at outcomes in that. I was wondering, the primary is really the intermediate outcome, and then the secondary, the kind of final.
I think.
I'm wondering. That's why you said the primary and secondary. I was just wondering, but theoretically and terminology-wise.
Yeah, I think basically, to me, this is this. There's also an sort of a connection to Sen's conceptualization here, in that he kind of talks about choice as both the principal means and the primary end of development. So in a sense, this is an echo of Sen.
Okay.
I guess the other thing is, if you look at the arrow connections here, I'm trying to emphasize that this is a process view of development. I'm not suggesting a one-way direction of causality. I'm not suggesting development as a state. I'm constantly talking about process, and I'm also suggesting this kind of these feedback loops throughout. So, you know, for any given case, I can tell you some of these kind of interconnections and how achieved outcomes then affect their agencies and their resources, and might, if they collectively make a change, might actually affect the structure. And I'm, you know, excited about those possibilities as well.
How do you think about it? So you did an individual case. How does it scale up to think about different, a larger, more heterogeneous kind of either organization or community, or, you know, I mean, I'm not saying it couldn't work, but how do you, can you?
I guess, this is sort of, it's a journey of exploration. It's a living tool. I'm in kind of a project that I'm currently working on or working towards is particularly theoretically interested in the relationship between individual choice and collective choice. If you wanted to sort of decide what would be appropriate criteria for Chilakompra, for example, would be a classic question of, well, how do you make sort of decisions based on collective choice when an individual public servant then has to translate this into a representative choice, for example. So I think there's plenty of interesting work on this particular boundary. It's, by the way, something that comes up in connection with the capabilities approach a lot. Theoretically, it's basically the relationship between individual and collective choice. I do think that this kind of comes into the planning for choice application. You can, I think, look at this and basically say, right, as an NGO or whatever, what's the particular lever that we want to apply in this system? If we think of development as a process, what do we want to affect? Okay, so we want to affect an individual's or several individuals' information base, for example. At the same time, we'd like to that way affect discourse, for example. You start mapping how an intervention might affect different elements of this framework, and then you can talk about potential collective empowerment also coming out of this. But this is very much work in progress. I wouldn't, at this point, I've got nothing of that written up. It's something that I'm kind of getting my head around as well. So thanks for the question.
Are you aware of or have you used Rolf Derendorf's work on life chances in this area?
I haven't. No.
It's really kind of interesting, I think, to fit into this because he talks about the book Life Chances talks about choices in his model of choices versus ligatures, which are ties to the land and the community, and shows how they sometimes intersect productively and sometimes they don't. And I was thinking about this woman who has access to the person who runs the info central. And in a sense, that's a ligature, that's a tie to people. For her becomes an opportunity to leapfrog into that other space of where she becomes competitive in this new environment that's been created around her. So I think the way he talks about that may turn out to be useful.
Interesting. Thank you.
And could you repeat the name of the author?
Rolf Derendorf. D-A-H-R-E-N-D-O-R-F, maybe something like that. The book I'm thinking, he's written a lot of things, but the book I'm thinking of is called Life Chances.
Sociologist, former director of the LSE. Okay. Okay.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your thoughts on the psychological outcomes? You mentioned that earlier.
The psychological resources.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, basically, this is. I don't have any additional slides to show here, but one of the things I find interesting, sort of a change from the DFID approach, the livelihood framework approach, is that DFID kind of talks particularly about sort of social capital. And human capital. Human capital I'd subdivide in educational capital and health, but I'm also saying that there's actually more quote-unquote capitals of the poor than the ones that DFID identify. So DFID talk particularly, there's generally a discourse of social capital as being this great capital of the poor. And for my research, I actually find that psychological resources is an important other resource of the poor. I'm slightly worried about this finding because there's been plenty of examples where there's been, basically a discourse of basically saying, hey, you're poor, but therefore, why don't you just pull yourself up by your bootstraps, pull yourself together, use your psychological resources, and get your act together, and the state doesn't need to help you because why don't you just develop your psychological resources? So I worry about that finding because of it could be misused, and I worry about this kind of abuse of this particular finding. However, I think if you just assume that you need to have, a social policy for everyone in the same way, that you're also not necessarily recognizing the agency of the individual sort of sufficiently, and I worry particularly that there are, you know, the kinds of ways that sort of poverty is conceptualized by the individual is very diverse, and there's plenty of literature on culture of poverty and basically a way in which people become sort of caught in discourses of sort of passive recipients of help and aid. And I think it's important to recognize that individuals have often through adversity actually quite a lot of, you know, psychological resources themselves. And it, you know, and it's particularly with these micro-entrepreneurs, they are not just, you know, passive victims or passive beneficiaries and so on. It's important to recognize that they have this agency and these psychological resources. So I'm kind of caught between these kind of you know, dangers of using that particular finding in different politically useful ways. But I think it's just a finding that it's like poor people often also have psychological resources to support them in their kind of in their search for, you know, finding more better life chances and greater possibilities of lead the lives that they value.
I think if it's your finding, you have to go with it. And one way to think about the context is, if less poor people have lack psychological resources, they still have a structural environment with which within which they can achieve anyway. Mm-hmm. So the structure still remains important, even while you're willing to recognize the psychological aspect as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's interesting how this translates into you know, different environments. You know, I look at some you know, sort of young people in the UK and how they deal with kind of life challenges and adversity, and then if you look at sort of young people in say in a sub-Saharan Africa context, say in Kenya or so, they, you know, the resilience of young people in, you know, a slum area in Africa is just that much more. It's, you know, it's kind of, it's sort of psychological resilience partly come out of adversity. And it's, again, is something that kind of comes up, and I think it's important to recognize that psychological resources can come out of adversity as well as kind of success and support.
I think the term you have here, though, psychological resources, because it sounds like something external, but you seem to be talking about something quite internal.
Yes.
So it sounds like some mixed voice.
Right. Well, yeah.
I'm tracking it correctly here from what you're talking about. You're talking about resilience. You used the term they just used a moment ago.
Yes. Well,
and
I think
the example you used with the woman from Marta and how she was able to get over the problems that she had from her spouse.
Yeah.
I'm coping skills. These are all internal things.
Well, I think yes. In many ways, the psychological resources are internal. So we're talking about sort of things like creativity, ability to envisage, mm-hmm. Ability to deal with a setback and come back after it, ability to deal with failure and writing a narrative for yourself that basically tells you about how you grew stronger through it. In Marta's case, also spite, you know, basically spiting her husband and basically saying, mm-hmm. look what I did anyways. These are kind of sort of, they have a personal origin. I guess what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to build a bridge between an existing framework, which is the livelihoods framework, which uses the term capital, which I'm not comfortable with, mm-hmm. because especially when it comes to social capital and so on, it kind of also signifies sort of a commodification of a lot of kind of, you know, social contacts into a kind of, you know, very econocentric discourse. So capital is not something that I'd like to kind of use in this context. resources is for me is a bridge between that discourse and a more sort of people-centered, humanistic discourse there.
Maybe, well, if I understand correctly, the resources are internal, but the environment, the example that you gave of the kids in Slum area in Africa, they are more resilient. The environment provides incentive or not for those resources to develop, right?
Yes, and yeah. I mean, and unfortunately, I mean, in a way, it's not clear cut. So a cuddled childhood where the parents are very careful to kind of protect them of all kinds of negative influences might still lead to very insecure young human beings. So there isn't a good recipe here. And it's one of the areas that I'm very interested in to work, for example, interdisciplinary with some colleagues in educational psychology to kind of consider some of the theoretical implications of this.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm misusing this, if I can bring that example to our experience
with
the crisis in Chile. One of the psychological resources in the context of a crisis are mostly shattered because people are, in the context of the tsunami and the earthquake and the confusion and emotional toll. Mm-hmm. And so one of the aspects of the earthquake, the Ashwin, well, the disaster that the government never dealt with was the psychological impact of the disaster in people, right? Yeah. Whereas telecenters and libraries actually use both the technology and the space, we were talking about the social space, to help people overcome, or not overcome, at least manage to whatever extent possible, the psychological effects. And if I'm using your terminology, reveal some of those psychological resources that because of the disaster and the loss, they either lost momentarily or temporarily or perhaps forever. So,
And I mean, to use that example, arguably, people also... in some contexts in Chile, I mean, there's a lot of, at least at the time and the particular space I was in, there was a lot of government intervention in trying to help people. And there was also a psychological dependency on the state as being, basically, I'm a poor micro-entrepreneur, what do? I think about how I could get a subsidy to get a machine. Yeah, and... That's what I call it's a projector economy, projector economy. It's kind of basically thinking about how do I get a subsidy for X, Y, Z. And while it's important to have those kinds of institutions that support, poor people in order to kind of balance out, in a pro social equity model, the psychological dependency is a real issue. And so here we have one of these issues that I have with the outcome in terms of psychological resources, that you potentially put a pro-poor policy in place, and it can happen that you can have negative effect on psychological resources through psychological dependency on the state. It's not to argue that the state shouldn't care.
Sure.
And in your case, I think with the disaster and the earthquake, and basically where there were the limits of what the state could do for you, one of the experiences must have been, I'm looking to the state to help me. There is no state. What do I do? And then the emergence of self-help. And again, I'm not suggesting that, hooray, like David Cameron, self-help, make your own schools. I'm not suggesting a rollback of the state, but I am suggesting that we do need to recognize that, you might, in a disaster situation or when you don't have a state or whatever, you might develop psychological resources, by emancipating yourself from that psychological dependence.
You're right. Some were shattered, some were created and revealed.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.